I'd like now to welcome Richard Moe. He is former president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, former chief of staff for Vice President Walter Mondale and advisor to President Jimmy Carter. He's author of the new book, Roosevelt's Second Act, The Election of 1940 and the Politics of War. And he will be speaking tomorrow night at 6 at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
So how did you decide to write about this very brief time in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's long presidency, 1939-1940?
Well, when I retired from my day jobs after 50 years, I knew I wanted to write. And I love American history, and I had a strong interest and background in politics. So FDR is somebody I've always been fascinated by. And thanks to a friend, I discovered that this period of 1940, when he decides to run for a third term, has never been explored before. Why and how did he decide to run for an unprecedented third term? There was a wonderful body of literature that I had available to me, and I just decided to try to get into his head, and that's what this book is all about.
It's interesting because when you think about this time, it's pre-Pearl Harbor. It's pre the worst horrors of World War II and Adolf Hitler. And because all these things hadn't happened yet, the country really had no idea what was coming. Franklin Delano Roosevelt saw what was coming in a very prescient way, but the rest of the country had no clue. What did Roosevelt know that the rest of America didn't?
He believed that war was eventually coming to America. And his goal here was to put off U.S. involvement in the war as long as possible to prepare the country for that eventuality, which of course came, as you suggest, to Pearl Harbor. But he couldn't get too far ahead of public opinion because the country was very isolationist at that point. So he put his emphasis on trying to get aid to Great Britain, which he saw as the first line of defense for the United States. If Britain collapsed and if they lost their fleet, then America was very, very vulnerable. And so all of his efforts were focused on trying to get as much military aid as possible to Britain.
Let's talk for a moment about American isolationism. We were such an isolationist nation. What are the roots of that in our own history?
The roots of isolationism are fascinating, and they go back to the days of Washington and Jefferson, who warned the country against foreign entanglements. They thought that there was no good to come to the country by being involved in international affairs beyond trade. Then we had the Monroe Doctrine and other things, and it served the country very well for a long period of time because we thought the oceans would protect us. We were invulnerable. That broke down a little bit in World War I, but especially in the Midwest, but really in all sections of the country, people after World War I didn't want to have anything to do with what was going on in Europe. They thought we had been hoodwinked into going into World War I. Debts hadn't been paid. Very ungrateful nations. The bankers prospered. And they thought that getting involved again was a fool's errand. So isolationism was very deep and widespread in the United States. Roosevelt, on the other hand, was a confirmed internationalist. He believed we should be engaged in the rest of the world. And one of the great consequences of his election in 1940 was that the end of isolationism. He got a mandate from this election to give aid to Britain. That's where Lend-Lease came from. The United States became the great arsenal of democracy. And the foundations for the national security state that we have become since. That was all seeded in 1940. So it was a hugely consequential election in that respect.
Right, and probably FDR, who was not a great fan of war, would shudder to see what has come from that time that he seeded.
I think he might very well. I think he might very well. There's a lot of curiosity about that.
So this was unprecedented in American history that FDR would run for a third term as president. What made him decide to run? Was it the war specifically in Europe?
Yes, it was the war. He had fully planned to retire to his beloved Hyde Park. He was building his library, built a retreat. He had to replenish his finances. He was all set to go up there. But he left a small caveat. If there's war, and if there was no one else who could support his policies and who could be elected in the Democratic Party, then he would consider running again. And that's what happened. But it didn't happen really until May of 1940, right before the Democratic Convention, when Hitler invaded France and the Low Countries. So it was definitely the war that changed his mind.
and seeing the importance of protecting and really being in alliance with our democratic allies in Europe.
That's correct. That's correct. He was trying to support the democracies, and principally Britain and France. France fell fairly quickly after Hitler invaded, so it was just Great Britain standing alone.
Now, how did FDR and his democratic allies in the United States go about fighting this whole idea that so many people had, namely American isolationism? I mean, this was not something that you could just lay on people and say, here's what we're doing. They had to be gradually convinced. How did that happen?
That's exactly right. And he held a number of fireside chats, his famous fireside chats. But after Hitler invaded Poland in early September of 1939, he then continued his efforts, which so far had been unsuccessful, to amend the Neutrality Act and repeal the arms embargo. Before then, he couldn't get aid to Britain and France. But he used that event, and he thought only events could change public opinion, not so much his own words. But after that event, the momentum built, because people saw what was at stake in Europe, and they began to see the seeds of what eventually happened. If Hitler conquered all of Europe, that was very bad news for America.
So the things that you were referring to a moment ago were laws that were put in place specifically to keep in place American isolationism and non-involvement.
Precisely. It was part of the legacy of World War I that I mentioned earlier. And FDR said he regretted signing that Neutrality Act in 1935. He publicly acknowledged his mistake, and he tried to amend it, and he finally did succeed in amending it.
We're talking to Richard Moe about his book, Roosevelt's Second Act. So in the 1940 election, and it's always striking when you read American history, especially if you're not an American historian, how utterly forgotten the candidate who lost really is. So Wendell Willkie was the Republican candidate for president in 1940. Who was he? What did he stand for? What did the Republicans stand for at that time?
Wendell Willkie was a native of Indiana. He came really from nowhere. It was one of the most incredible elections in American history. He beat all the traditional conservatives. He had been a Democrat until a year before the election, and he agreed with most of FDR's New Deal, and he was a confirmed internationalist, as FDR was. But what changed the dynamic of the Republican nominating process was the outbreak of war in Europe. They saw that whoever they nominated could be president, and he had to be able to handle this. And they were increasingly of the view that aid to Britain was essential. So Tom Dewey and Robert Taft and Arthur Vandenberg and the traditional conservative candidates just didn't measure up in their view. So he had a very dramatic nomination in Philadelphia in June of 1940. He was an incredible man, and after he lost the election, he and Roosevelt worked together to pass Lend-Lease. It was an act of great statesmanship, and Roosevelt gave him full credit for making Lend-Lease possible, which was really the mandate from the election. They both helped produce that mandate. Wendell Willkie is unfortunately one of the forgotten men of American history. That's what happens to you if you lose a presidential election.
Yeah.
But he deserves a great biography. Unfortunately, there's one now in the works.
Is that right?
Yes.
Not written by you?
Not written by me, by any means.
So if he had been a Democrat and he stood for the New Deal, and of course a lot of the conservative Republicans were against the New Deal, how did he go over in his own party?
He was the chairman of a big national gas consortium, Southwestern Gas. And the one thing he disagreed strongly with FDR on was the regulatory policies of the utilities, particularly his own utility. And he violently disagreed with the Tennessee Valley's authority and the competition, which he thought was unfair for his own industry. So that was the difference, and he became kind of the darling of the liberal Republicans. This was an era when there were liberal Republicans.
Right, right.
And he had a very charismatic personality, and he was persuaded by a number of friends and colleagues to run. And he did run, and he ran a brilliant campaign, grassroots campaign, first one ever on the Republican side. And it was, as I say, a very dramatic moment in Philadelphia when he got the nomination.
It's interesting, in your book, there are quite a number of echoes of our own time. And one thing that was kind of striking to me was when Willkie and his one of his campaign speeches. Was it he who was quoted or somebody else who was quoted as saying that the people who were voting for Roosevelt were the paupers of our country? And it was just like Mitt Romney's 47% remark.
That's correct. It wasn't Wilkie who said that, but it was Arthur Kroc, who was a prominent political reporter for the New York Times, quoting a Philadelphia Republican.
That's right.
Who said this. And, of course, FDR picked this up and just knocked it out of the ballpark because the paupers, so-called, as defined by that gentleman, constituted one half of the population of the United States.
So right.
That was a very impolitic thing to say.
And I'm struck every time I read about American history how many cycles of thought and action recur generation after generation. And how the ideas and how the fights that we're having in Congress and the fights in the media and public opinion are ever recurring set of ideas. I mean, what are some of the echoes that you see having written this book in our own time?
Well, that's a really good question, Mary Charlotte. One of them is isolationism. There is now there are some neo-isolationists who don't think that we should be involved to the extent that we are in parts of the world. That's a very small minority at this point. But you do hear those echoes. One thing that's very striking now is President Obama's weighing, he made the decision to go to Congress to get the authority to act against Syria for the indiscriminate gassing of civilians.
Which is what our Constitution says he has to do.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. There is some constitutional authority, I'm told, that allows him to act unilaterally. And more importantly, he thinks he has the authority. But he thought for other reasons he had to go to the Congress. The question is, what would FDR have done? The only guidance to answering that question is what he did with the Destroyers for Bases deal. Churchill was desperate for old World War I era U.S. destroyers to guard his convoys. And Roosevelt didn't think he could get it through the Congress. So he found a way to send them on his own initiative. And through a legal theory that Dean Acheson and his own attorney general came up with. And the Congress was pretty much fine with that. They didn't want to have to make a controversial decision. So you speculate on what would, if President Obama had made this decision to strike Syria on his own initiative and on his own legal authority, what would members of Congress have done? There would have been some critics, for sure. But I think a lot of them would have been relieved that they didn't have to make that decision.
But as you mentioned, it was a different time and a different kind of Congress. There were liberal Republicans as there are not today. Was there bipartisanship at that time?
There was much more bipartisanship for the most part. And FDR had the support of a lot of liberal Republicans on a lot of his New Deal measures in the first term. But on repealing the arms embargo, which I mentioned earlier, the conservative Democrats from the South supported him almost unanimously. The liberal Republicans opposed him. But for the most part, there was much more bipartisanship than there is now. And Wendell Willkie really exemplified that. Because a lot of the people that were supporting arms to Britain in particular were Republicans.
So, having written this book, Roosevelt's Second Act, what do you think are the most important lessons we can learn by looking at that time?
I think the lessons that I take away from it really have a lot to do with FDR. Who was this man, and what was he about, and what were the qualities that he had that led to the kind of leadership that made such a difference both at home and abroad? And there's not a simple answer to that question, but there was a duality to Roosevelt. I mean, he set very principled goals, honorable goals, but he was sometimes cautious and ambitious and even arrogant and manipulative sometimes in pursuing those goals. So James McGregor Burns, my former professor, famously called this the lion and the fox, and others are more... All I tried to do was to lay out the facts so the people could make them. But to see, and he, in terms of decision-making, he didn't have a National Security Council. He didn't have a Central Intelligence. He had nothing. Nobody in the White House to advise him. All this was in his head. He had a few cabinet officers. He made up his own intelligence network from friends and people who came back from Europe and wanted to share their experiences with him. So that's where we began to build the national security state that we are today. So there's an enormous contrast from that time to this. And I think it's worth looking back on how we got here.
And just the charismatic nature that this person had and the strength of his own ability to make decisions and stick to them and convince other people. I don't know what you call it, but that kind of personal power that he had was immense, and you get kind of a sense of that reading your book.
Well, thank you. His decision-making is an incredibly interesting phenomenon. He was a famously social person. He always wanted to be surrounded by people, even in very tense situations. On the other hand, he was a very solitary individual. He was a loner. He grew up as an only child in a remote setting. And in making major decisions, he made them entirely on his own. He would get advice from people, but as even his wife Eleanor said, he had no confidence, not even me. And this decision for a third term was one of those decisions that he didn't really consult with anybody on. He made it over a period of 8 or 9 months, evolving. And he never made these decisions until the very last moment. So presidential decision-making is something that fascinates me. And President Obama and most other recent presidents don't have that kind of process. They have a lot of advisors. They have structured organizations within and without the White House to advise them and to inform them. FDR had none of that.
The book is called Roosevelt's Second Act, The Election of 1940 and the Politics of War by Richard Moe, former president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation and former chief of staff for Vice President Walter Mondale and advisor to President Jimmy Carter. Richard will be speaking tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.